Tonight we're still in lesson number 18, book of Acts chapter 27, and we're on page number 60 in the lesson book, and we're about to get to the end of it. We got down to question number 10 last week. We discussed about Paul being delivered to Rome, and then this is the process of him getting there to see Caesar, to be tried of Caesar. They got caught in a storm. And as we talked last week, it seemed like everything they were trying to accomplish and do kept getting held up. They needed to be a certain place to beat the wintertime, and they got held up. And so it just seemed like it was, things just kept happening. Then they end up at the place to where it wasn't good for them to winter in, so they had to move on. And so then they get caught in the big storm. Soon after they left the fair havens, and this storm is considered a southwest wind that stirs up waves. And the stirring of the waves, as we talked about, was not little bitty waves. This was stuff tossing ships back and forth, white capping, probably throwing the ship around every which way. And we were reading or talking about how the trouble they have, and they were about to give up. And actually, verse 20, I believe it is, they had give up hope. The hope was taken away, it says. They gave up. And now we're going to see the turn of that piece of the story tonight. But as our custom has been, let us read. We read part of the chapter last week, and so just to finish up the chapter, we'll read verses 39 through the end of the chapter. Does anyone want to volunteer to read?
Acts chapter 27.
That's correct.
39.
Mm-hmm, to the end of the chapter.
When day came, they could not recognize the land, but they did observe that they had beach, and they drove the ship onto it as they could. And casting off the anchor, wanting to bring Paul safely through, kept them from their intention, and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land. And the rest should follow, some on planks and others on very sinking ship. And so it happened that they all were brought safely.
All right. Question number 10 is, what two statements did Paul make about his relationship to God that should be the attitude of every Christian? Yeah, that's two. I was thinking of verses 21 through 25 there, which he said to fear not. And as you said, I believe God. I took that statement and highlighted it in my Bible, because it's so important for us to carry on this attitude that I believe God. He tells them to be of good cheer, for there is no loss of any man's life among you but that of the ship. That's very difficult for them to see when they're seeing the storm. They're caught in this storm, and they've let the ship go on, let it drive at this point in the story. This idea that to fear not and to believe what God has to say, believe that he's going to do what he said he's going to do, to me, this is a great example of faith over fear. Because you're in a fearful situation, you're in a situation where it looks like loss of life, but God says you're going to make it through. And it looks doubtful. If you're riding that ship up and down, sideways, getting hit with waves, whatever the situation might be, Most likely, Paul being a prisoner on the ship, they most likely had them on the top deck to get them, you know, because this is a cargo ship, because we see the material that's going to be emptied off of it. So the ship is probably very heavy, actually, with those things, even though they've eliminated a few things. So this thing's getting tossed around. It looks like that all is going to be lost. And Paul says, God said we're going to make it. So next question is, what does believing God really mean? What does it mean to you, believing God?
It's not just a matter of knowing that He exists. I mean, that is obviously a critical part of it, as Hebrews 11:6 points out. But it's trusting in that God that created you. Trusting His guidance, trusting His divine revelation. What He has said, He's going to perform. Abraham did that. He demonstrated, and he's the archetype in the Bible of faith. He's one of the first men that we study about, you know, very early on in the Bible, where one of the key things that stands out about Abram is his faith. And so he's an archetype. He's called the father of the faithful because of that. And so what did he do? He trusted God's word, left his homeland, left his country behind, ultimately, and eventually left his family behind, with the exception, of course, of his wife Sarai, who became Sarah later. And then, you know, as he completed that obedience, God blessed him for his obedience. And so, later on in life, once he finally had a child of promise, even though he loved that child more than anything in the world, this is something he had waited a lifetime for, 100 years old before Isaac ever came into the world. This is something he longed for his whole life, and God said, give it up for me. And he was willing to. If he's willing to do that, Abraham would have done anything God commanded.
He was in hook, line, and sinker.
And so when Paul is shown this by divine revelation, even though the situation he's in doesn't look good, he's such a great contrast from the faith, we might say the immature faith, the lack of faith of the early apostles. You look at the apostles after Jesus' resurrection, and they're so immovable. Peter's in prison, and what? He's snoozing it up. No worries. Prison, death, who cares? I'm going to be with the Lord. Paul, doesn't matter. He knows who he has believed in, and he truly was confident that he is able to perform what was committed to him, as he wrote to Peter.
Right out of Scripture.
So, it's so amazing to look at the development of these men's faith. I mean, here's a man that once persecuted the church late Christ. Incidentally, of course, was persecuting Jesus in that process because they were his people. And here he is, willing to go to Rome to testify of Christ Jesus and ultimately give an account before Caesar, which I believe he knew by this point was going to result in the end game was going to be he's going to die for his sake.
And he's okay with that.
And he is already at peace with that. And here he is, and he says, we're going to face shipwreck. God has showed me this. He's let me know. We're going to face shipwreck. We're going to be on an island, you know. But we're going to, not one of us is going to perish in that process. I mean, and he trusted it. He believed that. And I think even some of the men that were probably traveling with Paul wound up believing Paul's words. But anyway.
Oh, I believe that too. There's no way they couldn't have. They have it. If you after going through what they went through with him telling them what they're going to do, what's going to happen, then we get in chapter 28 and see what happens on the island, and so forth. It's kind of like you have to purposefully harden your heart against that.
We have to translate for us. Translate that, make application for us too. Just as God has shown Paul that, he has shown us his son is going to be sent back to take us to glory. There is going to be a great day of judgment. There is going to be a great day of resurrection in the last day. We do not know when that day or that hour is. Not the angels in heaven, but the Father only. But all that said, we look forward to that day because we know who we have trusted and believed in. And so that's a paramount aspect of faith.
You've already answered the next part of the question, but somebody else might want to fill in the blank with another person. Does what man is given as a real example of this kind of faith?
Abraham's. There's a lot of
Paul's. You know, you could list Paul. There's a list.
Joseph,
big long.
Betrayed by his brothers in the Genesis account, is a great example of trusting God and staying faithful to God in the midst of what seemed like utter loss and betrayal. And just, I mean, what man wouldn't have hardened his heart in Joseph's shoes?
Yeah, and
the most faithful of men would have stayed true to God under those circumstances, and he did.
And what he says at the end of the story. God
meant it for
you. Meant it from evil, but God meant it for good.
That's powerful.
He knew his place. Yeah. He knew where his place was. That's where I think sometimes we miss the boat. We forget what our place is.
That same statement.
And where it is.
Parallels in Christ and his crucifixion. We intended it for evil. We with God's hands took him and crucified him, but God meant it for good. It's powerful, man.
It is.
That's a cross statement.
Brother Jones, you say so. That'll preach right there.
Yeah, that'll preach.
You had something?
I said Isaiah. That's a good one as well.
Yeah.
In terms of, in his eyes, I mean, all of Israel, like, there was, in his eyes, like few people who still worshiped and believed in God. But God was reassuring them, hey, they're about, 18,000, but not bowed the knee to Baal.
Oh, 7,000, yeah. Are you talking about Elijah?
That would be Elijah.
Yeah, that's Elijah. But yeah, I that's a great example of faith. His perseverance, despite the fact that he was the only one left doing it right, as he thought, anyway. He turned out being wrong in that one aspect, but nevertheless, he was being faithful regardless of how few there were.
Question number 12 is, what did the shipmen sense on the 14th night? Verse 27, question 12. What did the shipmen sense on the 14th night?
Yep.
Huh?
Land was near.
Yep, land was near. They were coming to some country. And what action did they take?
They sounded to see how far off they were.
Now, it's not in the questions here, but he mentioned that they sounded, and it was so many fathoms, they waited a while and sounded again. How long is a fathom?
I've got this jotted down in another place in my Bible because of
it,
that question.
It's real simple. This is a fathom. The length from the tip of this finger to the tip of this finger, your middle fingers with your arms stretched out, that's roughly your height. Your wingspan, most people's wingspan is the same as their height. Do you know that? So this is basically the wingspan. So between 5 to 6 feet is your common measurement.
I was thinking of furlong, sorry.
Yeah,
furlongs is a completely different
thing. Oh, yeah. Yep.
That's a 15 feet.
Yep, so this is a fathom. And so this gives you an idea about how far they were away. They wasn't that far, if you think about it. They wasn't that far when they figured out, hey, we're getting close to something. And I've wondered how they figured this out, how they figured how close they were. You know, they sounded first, it was 20 fathoms. So that's a few hundred feet. No, a little over 100 feet. Because 20 times 5 would be 100, right? If you went 5 foot measurement. And then they'd gone a little further, it says. They sounded again, it was 15. So they shrunk that distance down in a hurry. And what kept the shipment from fleeing the ship? Let's back up to verse 30 before we answer that question. This is the section where I'd have probably put two or three more questions in here if I was writing this out. But anyway, verse 30. Well, let's go to 29. And fearing lest we have fallen upon rocks, they cast the anchors out the stern and wished for the day. And as the shipmen were about to flee the ship, when they had let down the boat into the sea under color, they thought that they would have cast anchors out of the foreship. The question is, what is this statement under color? It's real simple. Huh? Well, this idea of under color is they done this under a pretense. In this case, a negative pretense. They were trying to sneak out. They're trying to sneak off the ship. And that in another translation, it translates it this way. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea under pretense of laying out anchors for the bow. So they're like, we're looking like we're doing this, but really what we're doing is about to make our escape. That's what it means to do it under color in the old English, in the King James Version. They're just being deceptive. Yes. And it says, and Paul said to the centurions, except these abide in the ship, you cannot be saved. Boy, I've heard probably 3 or 4 lessons in my lifetime on this verse right here. Unless you abide in the ship, you cannot be saved. And I kind of think that Marshall Keeble's got a lesson based on that verse. Unless these abide in the ship, you cannot be saved.
Probably drew some parallels from Noah and the ark and then
usually you start out with, I've heard most people I've heard give a lesson like if they start out with Noah. So brings us to question 13. What kept the shipmen from fleeing the ship? What'd they do? After Paul tells them that. Cut the ropes. Now, think about this. What these little boats are talking about are ships, if you read the King James. It's the little lifeboats that's hanging on the side. Cut them off. Nobody's leaving. Cut them off and let them go. This would be, some people think that this could have been the little, I don't know if you call it a little dinghy boat or what, that would go like from the shore because the ship couldn't get to the shore because the water was too shallow. One of those kind of boats that would transport back and forth. Either way, it was one to give you an escape path. And so they cut the ropes, let it go, got rid of it. To keep the ones in the ship.
Part, not the 4 anchors that are referenced.
Right, earlier, right.
But the latter part where they were feigning, like they were going to throw some more anchors off or something. But
yep.
They were really going to try to sneak off on a small.
Yep, that's what we're talking about.
Definitely shady. That's how we would say color now. We would say that's shady.
That's shady. That's a good way to put that, shady. What were the, okay, we've kind of already answered it, but what was the condition of them being saved? Staying in the ship. Number 14 is, where was God's place for safety when Israel took Jericho?
God's place of safety when Israel took Jericho?
Yep. Think about it. It's more simple than that.
Outside the city? Because everybody inside died?
Well, now think about it. What was the safety for them? Obedience.
Oh, yeah.
Obedience. We're not talking about loss of life. We're thinking about preservation of life.
Okay.
Which would be to obey God. Because if they didn't obey God, the walls wouldn't have fell. All these things wouldn't have transpired. And they would have potentially been overtaken by the people of Jericho later on. Where is God's appointed place for safety today?
The church is the body of the saved, as we see in Acts chapter 2, the end of the chapter. So you could say the church is the vessel of the saved, the body of the saved. You could probably put it in a lot of different words, but. Yeah, the church.
Yeah, in the church. Also thought about the carrying on the idea of obedience as well, is still in obedience to him, which would have one in the church.
Yeah, you're not in the church until obedience.
That's right. Can't do it any other way. Verse 15 is why, or excuse me, question 15, why did Paul urge the men to eat? For their survival, for their health, because they hadn't eaten.
Some of them would probably faint because if they had refrained from eating for these 14 days, they would have been nearly starved to death by this point, but it, I don't think there's any indication that they fasted though, before, you know, but just saying, like, if they've gone several days without eating and they're trying to, like, hold on to their rations because they don't know when they're going to make land and, you know, whatever reason, Paul is urging them to eat because they're going to need their strength.
Yep. They're going to need it. Well, we got to remember, too, that he's already told them it's going to be lost to the ship. Sometime or another, you're going to have to hit the water.
Isn't that hilarious? You got to stay in the ship, but the ship's going to wreck.
Yeah, and then when it wrecks, you're out.
And once it breaks apart, then you're going to be able to hold on to pieces of it.
Yep.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
Yep. So the next part of the question is, what expression shows the breaking of bread here refers to a common meal? I put down, this is for your health. I thought that might be what they're fishing for, because the Lord's Supper is not for your health. It's not what the Corinthian brethren fouled that up, didn't they? Because they were using the Lord's Supper for a common meal. And he was saying, some of you are coming hungry, eating till you're full.
It's a threefold.
Shameful.
That's something we must never forget about the Lord's Supper. It's threefold. It's a communion of the body and blood of Christ. It's not a communion where it becomes the literal body and blood, as Catholics teach it in transubstantiation, but it's a communion by faith. It's also a proclamation of Christ's death until he returns, as 1 Corinthians 11 says. You do proclaim the Lord's death until he come again. So that's our way of, as a church, as the body of Christ, announcing his death. We are signifying that, and then there's the memorial aspect of it. And it's a threefold purpose.
And it's very, very sacred, and we ought to look at it and approach it as such. Now, I believe that this breaking of bread refers to a common meal, you know, first because of what it says, for your health, and they had not eaten for 14 days. I guess I've never heard anybody argue that this is the Lord's Supper, but I could see if someone makes a blanket statement that every time the words, breaking of bread refers to the Lord's Supper, then I could see him using this argument for that. But does anybody else have any thought about that? Because I thought that, you know, that for your health would be the distinguishing factor as pulling it out of the scripture here.
It just says that he had taken bread and broke it, but doesn't even use that phraseology of the breaking of bread. So they'd have trouble connecting that argument, even if they were going to try to go about it that way, because it doesn't really say the breaking of bread here. It just says he took bread and he was basically dispersing it to them. And I think that would be a little bit different context. Plus, all these men weren't believers, so obviously this is not the Lord's Supper, which is the common sense answer that we might give somebody.
Right.
And they were breaking a fast also. Would take the Lord's Supper to break a fast. They've been fasting.
Yeah, you wouldn't. That's right. Well, I hadn't thought about it. Yeah.
That's right.
You wouldn't be breaking a fast with it.
No, because you're just going to
right.
Fill your belly.
Yep.
Because you're going to save meat.
Probably.
Mine is meat, not just bread.
What verse does it use the word meat? 33. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yes, take meat, and then they reference the bread later. Find us soon. Sorry. Meat is a generic term in the Bible for food. Doesn't necessarily mean preserved meat or something of that sort.
Look at verse 35 to get the bread.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, when he had thus spoken, he took bread and gave thanks. Well, yeah. No telling what they had. They might have eaten a handful of rice or something. I don't know.
Verse 36
wheat.
Does go on to say, though, they were all of good cheer, and they also took some meat. But I don't know if that's referencing the fact that they all began to partake of the bread or what. But anyway, whatever it is, it seems that, you know, they were able to fill their bellies. And that's the significance of it here. They needed their strength for what was about to happen.
Yes. Yes. Number, what are we up to, 15? Nope, 16. Even though some of the people on the ship were not Christians, what did Paul do before eating? Gave thanks. Thanks to God. I don't know, but don't we indicate that some of them kind of brought some stuff along? I'd also like, also would think that on a trip like this, that you're not going to have.
You're not going to have fresh meat.
You're not going
to
have. You're not going
to
have
ready to eat or yeah, you can, preserved, or it's going to be. Yeah, and the same true of grain, because you're not going to light fires on your vessel. You're going to have pre-made bread.
Yeah.
And you're going to try to store it in a way to where it doesn't become stale and get exposed to the air too much.
Just or wet.
Maybe some kind of like jerky or
yeah, that's a
it's
possibility.
A very archaic thing, yeah.
Or
yeah, like salting meats, drying meats, that's all common.
Or it could have just been well preserved, I don't know.
Yeah. I know when the pilgrims and you know, well after this, but on some of the sunken vessels, they found canned goods, like in jars with lids on them. If you remember, one of the problems with some of the vessels that did come over the East India Trading Company and some of them, where they had lost a lot of people food poisoning, was through the preservation of food. They used lead-lined tops and stuff like that, didn't understand that was poison. So
they figured it out eventually.
They did. When enough people died, they figured, oh, this ain't right. Yep.
It's sad to say.
So anyway, there's some interesting things, you know, that's there with food storage. And, you know, what's to say, you know, what about eggs? You don't have to cook eggs. You can eat them raw.
Yeah.
Pickled.
People that work out do it all the time.
Yeah. You know, you think about salted things. Remember, this is also the eastern part of the world. What do they do with eggs a lot in the eastern part of the world? They bury them. Yeah. They bury them, let the sun bake them. And they'll let them dehydrate underground. That's a common in India. That's they have dishes like they call the 1,000-year-old egg and stuff like that. I'm not interested in eating anything like that. They basically let it spoil. And they bury them in the ground. They let them spoil. And then over time, after the spoiling, they dry out. Yeah, that's a good way to put it out. And then they'll dig them. It's a delicacy in some places. And they'll be.
Not delicate to me.
No, it's not something I would be interested in doing.
Sounds like a destructive force for my stomach.
Well, if it's laid there long enough, all the bacteria is dead. You know, things like that. But anyway, there's all kinds of ways to preserve food. And I would figure it was, would think it it's somebody that had, or they had food that's already prepared somewhat and that had been preserved. How many were on the ship?
276.
That's a lot of people. That's what we were talking about, how big the ship possibly was. Just think, this building, we can seat about 215, 210, something like that, in all of these seats. So they give you some perspective on the size.
The boat would have been probably twice as long as this room, this way, and at least this wide. To
yep.
give you an idea. I mean, that's about how big the boat was.
Yep.
And that was kind of an average size for the first century. I mean, you're talking about a boat that's usually somewhere between, if it's a smaller vessel, 75 to 100 feet, bigger vessel, 100 to 150 feet easily. And that's a pretty big boat. I mean, that's a lot of wood.
Yep. Well, this room is 40 feet wide, 60 feet long.
And of course, they did some and that were even bigger, but that's more uncommon.
Brother Bill was telling us last week when he went and seen the, was it the Maria, the, what was his telling us about? The ships that had come over the Mayflower that they had preserved and how long and how big they were. There really wasn't that,
big.
They were saying they're like 100 feet, what was it, about 80 feet long or something like that. And I was like, it'd fit in this building, you know, if you let it stick out in the back and out the front the other way. But anyway.
Man,
So, you know, they were, I'm sure they were crowded on there, because also we've got to remember there was grain on the ship. They were transporting grain. Number 17, what were some of the different things they did in an effort to get the ship to land? Verse 40.
Taking out the anchors.
Well, around verse 40, I should say. Yeah, what the first thing they done was they lightened the ship. Second thing they done was they cast what? Cast the wheat in the sea. They lifted the anchors.
Does it sound like the way in verse 40, it sounds like they took up the anchors, but then they cut them, it seems like, or something, because it says they committed.
Yeah, they were loose from them.
Themselves unto the sea, or left them in the sea.
Yeah, because they were needing to lighten the ship.
Yeah, and an anchor is about the heaviest thing on the boat. So
yep.
Four of them, yeah. I mean, it's already specified four anchors back in verse 4.
Yeah, two in the front, two in the back. 29. Yeah.
So four anchors, and they all have quite a bit of weight. And I understand why they let them down at first, because you don't want to go just soaring into a
stick the nose in the ground.
Or an island or yeah. You don't know if you're going to hit sand or rock. So that'd be a lot of weight alone, not to mention all the other stuff they lightened the boat
To me, this has always been a question. If it was holding fast with those anchors, why didn't they just sit there? I'm just thinking through it, you know. But then again, we see that they're getting the violence of the storm, so I'm sure they're probably thinking this is our best shot to make it. All right, they let it go, let her drive. And so what happens next? It's not one of the questions. They go, 41, they go into where two seas meet, and they ran the ship aground, and the fore part stuck fast, and remained unmovable. The hinder part was broken with the violence of the waves. So they stuck the ship. And the next question is, what was the soldiers' counsel?
Kill
the prisoners, yeah, kill them. Why? Because they was worried about them getting away. And so what does the centurion, what was his, or why did the centurion not take this advice? He wanted to save Paul because he was one of the prisoners and he would have been killed.
Notice the expedience of man. Man quickly will come to the conclusion of, if it's going to be burdensome to us, let's just kill people. Let's just not value human life, like abortion.
Yep.
Whereas God values human life, and we see that here personified through the fact that he preserved 276 men, many of which clearly, based on their response here, didn't deserve even that type of grace.
But we got some mean people there.
Yeah, we see God's forbearance here. I mean, he could have let the ones that were saying stuff like this drown and preserved those that were, you know, just trying to survive, but he preserved all of them.
Yeah.
So that shows you the grace of our God.
Says a lot. Question number 19 is, what shows God's earlier promise to Paul was completely fulfilled? No life was lost. They made it safe to land. Maybe I shouldn't use the word safe, but they made it to land. Well, no, it does say safe. Verse 44, it says they escaped all safe to land. So that shows that God fulfilled his promise. Guarantee you somebody took notice of this. Because remember at the beginning, who had they listened to? The whole reason they set sail to start with. They listened to the master of the ship, right? And so now Paul's like, I told you. He told them then, this is not a good thing to do. So they did it anyways. They listened to him. And now notice that as the story has gone on, they've stopped listening to the master of the ship and they've started listening to Paul.
Yeah.
And
went from a respected seasoned sailor or this crazy religious guy.
That don't know anything about sailing.
By the end of it all, though, is the ship guy that doesn't know what he's doing versus a man of God.
Yep.
That he was held in much higher esteem by the end of it all, like you were pointing out. And the fact that he's going to get bit by a poisonous snake basically shortly after getting to land.
Yep, next chapter.
And it doesn't even faze him. That just really, really sets him even further apart.
I tell you what, I took notice of that. Said, I just seen you get bit and you shook it off and that didn't even miss a beat. That's crazy. That shows the power of God is what it does.
It's an easy thing to identify a poisonous snake. Poisonous snakes have the slanted eyes. Non-poisonous snakes have the rounded eyes. And I think it's almost universally across the board like that. Like if you have a snake with round eyes, it's not poisonous. But if they have slanted eyes, they're poisonous.
Doesn't also head shape come into that too?
Oh yeah, there's head shape, but the eyes are the giveaway. That's the thing. Like, if you can identify, it doesn't matter what snake you come in contact with.
Do what?
I'm not going to get close enough to look at your eyes.
You're not going
to
say, hold on there, open that eyelid, let me look at you. Oh, I tell you what, I've got some wild snake stories over the years that were from poisonous snakes. We walked by a cobra in Tanzania. I'd made all these trips over there all the years. He wasn't a king cobra, but it was a cobra, probably about that long.
Oh man.
Coiled up, laying on a stump, walked right by that thing. I mean like right by it. Because we was walking down the road and the girls with me said she wanted to go play with it. She's a snake person, so she saw it. American, by the way, not Tanzanian. Because Tanzanians are terrified of snakes because they see people die from them all the time. All these poison snakes they got running around, adders and all that. So
ask any black person.
And then she pulled me back.
Black people do not like snakes.
White people don't either.
Most of us don't, but some of them are crazy enough to play with them.
But they took us back. She hollered as we come back, looked at us like, I'm not touching that thing. But anyway, so
yeah,
I don't want to be bit.
I wouldn't want that thing wrapping around my arm or nothing.
Anyway, that's the only trip I'd ever seen snakes, and I've been over a bunch of times, and probably because I just walked past them. True or false, page 61. Luke was not with Paul on the journey. Question number two. The ship stopped at Salmon. Verses 7 and 8.
It sounded like something like that
from the right? No, so that place is mentioned.
The wind was not so suffering as we sailed under Crete over against Salmon, and hardly passing it came, they passed by it, but they didn't stop there.
That's right, so it's false. They went by it, didn't stop at it. Number three, the wind was tempestuous when they left the fair havens. Now, when did the problem start at the fair havens, though? It's false because...
Yeah, the wind was blowing softly at first.
That's right. When they left the fair havens, the wind was blowing softly, and soon after is when they hit the storm. The Euryclodon, or however you say it. Number four, Paul assured them that the ship would not be lost.
False.
Number 10.
Life would be lost.
Right. And number next, five. God assured Paul that he would be brought before Caesar.
That's true.
True, verse 24. All right, does anybody have any comments, additional comments or questions over this chapter? All right, appreciate your attention, and we'll pick up with chapter 28 next week.